This is VOA 1 Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lin, Susan Shen, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lin.
American zoos are taking steps to protect their animals from catching the new coronavirus from humans. The steps include many of the same measures used to slow the spread of the virus in humans. These include social distancing and cleaning shared equipment. Vaccines have also been used on animals. At the San Diego Zoo, a female orangutan became the first ape in the world to get a coronavirus vaccine in January. The vaccine was given after a group of gorillas started showing signs of infection and later tested positive for the coronavirus. The orangutan named Karen received two shots of a vaccine made by Zoetis, a New Jersey company that manufactures drugs for animals. Nine other primates at the San Diego Zoo have been fully vaccinated, five bonobos and four orangutans. Four more animals, one bonobo and three gorillas, got their first shots this month and will get a second in April. Nadine Lamberski is the wildlife health officer for the San Diego Zoo. She told the Associated Press that zoo officials acted quickly to vaccinate the animals in an effort to protect other great apes. The outbreak was linked to a zookeeper who was infected but had no signs of the virus. Seven gorillas got minor cases and recovered. But one older silverback gorilla developed the lung disease pneumonia, likely caused by the virus, as well as heart disease. He was put on medicines and received an antibody treatment to block the virus from infecting cells. About 36 zoos in the United States and other countries have placed orders for the Zoetis vaccine. It is meant to work on particular animal species. We will jump at the opportunity to get the Zoetis vaccine for our own great apes, said Oakland Zoo official Alex Herman. She is ordering 100 injections. Zoetis got permission from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to provide the vaccines on an experimental basis to the San Diego Zoo. The company will need to seek the same permission to provide the shots to additional zoos. Scientists believe the new coronavirus likely started in bats before jumping to humans. Now, many researchers worry that humans may unknowingly infect other animal species. Animal health experts say great apes, such as gorillas, are especially at risk of becoming infected. These animals share 98% of their DNA with humans. So far, confirmed coronavirus cases include gorillas, tigers and lions at zoos, domestic cats and dogs, farmed mink, and at least one wild mink in Utah. Scientists have also experimentally shown that ferrets, raccoon dogs, and white-tailed deer are at risk, although pigs and cows are not. Another concern is that virus spread among other species could produce new versions or variants. In Denmark, workers at a mink farm unknowingly infected the animals. As the coronavirus spread among the mink, it mutated and humans became infected with the new variant. In an effort to control the situation, the government ordered millions of mink to be killed. Scott Weiss is a microbiologist at Ontario Veterinary College in Canada. He told the AP that mutations happen when there's a lot of disease transfer going on between animals. Since the outbreak, the San Diego Zoo has been using a lot of fans at its indoor primate areas to improve airflow. Zoo workers also wear face coverings and limit their time spent inside with the animals. I'm Brian Lynn.
A very large container ship struck land and is blocking Egypt's Suez Canal waterway. At least 150 other ships cannot pass it, officials said. The ship, called the Ever Given, is registered in Panama. It usually carries cargo between Asia and Europe. It ran aground Tuesday in the man-made waterway that connects the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. Efforts to free the ship using heavy equipment have not been successful. Billions of dollars of products and supplies cannot pass through the canal as a result. The ship's Japanese owner offered a written apology Thursday for the incident. "We are determined to keep on working hard to resolve this situation as soon as possible," Shoei Kisen Kaisha Limited said. Officials began work again to free the ship Thursday morning after stopping for the night, an Egyptian canal official said. The official said workers hoped they would not have to unload the ship in an effort to free it because that would extend the closure. The official did not want to be identified because the person did not have permission to talk to reporters. Workers using heavy equipment have tried to clear dirt around the large ship. Other boats have tried to push it, but satellite pictures show it is still in the same place. A team from Voskalis, a Dutch company that specializes in such problems, arrived at the canal on Thursday. One of the company's top officials said moving the ship could take days to weeks. Voskalis chairman Peter Berdowski told a Dutch news program Wednesday night, "The ship, with the weight it has now, can't really be pulled free. You can forget it." Bernhard Schulte Ship Management is the company that supervises the Ever Given. It said the ship's 25-member crew is safe. Shoei Kisen Kaisha said all the crew came from India. Two pilots from Egypt's canal organization were on the ship to guide it when it struck land early Tuesday morning, Bernhard Schulte Ship Management said. Canal Services Company Leth Agencies said at least 150 ships were waiting for the Ever Given to be moved. Evergreen Marine Corporation is the large Taiwan-based shipping company that operates the ship. It said the Ever Given had been affected by strong winds as it entered the canal, something Egyptian officials also said earlier. Bernhard Schulte said there was no mechanical or engine failure. The British publication Lloyd's List estimates each day that the Suez Canal is closed affects over $9 billion worth of trade that should be passing through it. Nearly 25% of the ship traffic that passes through the Suez Canal is container ships like the Ever Given, it said. I'm Susan Shand.
One of our readers recently asked about the word breaking. I know about the word breaking, as in breaking glass, but what does it mean in breaking news? And what is the meaning of breaking bad? If you watch television news broadcasts from the United States, you often see the words breaking news. The noun break can mean something that causes a change or a delay in an action. You may hear a teacher say, "We will take a 10-minute break." Or you might enjoy a coffee break, a few minutes away from work. We have used the word break to mean to make a first and partial disclosure, that is, to make something known to the public, for a long time. The Online Etymology Dictionary says the word has been used this way for more than 750 years. In the news business, to break a story means to have the first report on the story. With social media like Twitter and Instagram, newsmakers and reporters can immediately send messages to the public. Being the first to report on an event or having an original story, a scoop, as reporters call it, is becoming more difficult. In the past, when there was a disaster or an important news event, reporters would interrupt a regular television or radio broadcast. They often said, "We interrupt this program for an important announcement." They did not use the words breaking news because it was clear they were breaking into the regular program. Some media organizations still use the term breaking news to describe such an unusual report. But on many other news programs, the words breaking news appear every day, without a real interruption to the normal broadcast. They seem to simply mean that there is a news report coming up. It is probably not an original story. The Cambridge Dictionary has a more up-to-date definition for breaking news. That is, information that is being received and broadcast about an event that has just happened or just begun. A popular U.S. television series, Breaking Bad, told the story of an average high school chemistry teacher who became a drug dealer. The creator of the series, Vince Gilligan, was born in Richmond, Virginia. Gilligan told the American Film Institute that when he wrote the story, he gave it that name because he thought it was a commonly known expression. When he was growing up in Southern Virginia, the term break bad meant to go wild or to break the law. Gilligan said you might hear someone say, "I was out the other night at the bar, and I really broke bad," ending up in a police car, for example. Breaking Bad's main character, Walter White, goes from a person you like to someone you hate. So breaking bad means for a good person to start doing bad things. The term is not very common, but it does appear in some movies and other television programs. In the 2016 movie, Fishes and Loaves, Heaven Sent, a character says, "Well, I mean, I guess we have our share of good old boys who break bad every now and again." In the U.S. South, good old boys refers to average local men. My advice to our readers is to understand that the words breaking news mean a broadcaster simply wants you to pay attention to their report. And I also advise you to stay away from anyone who is breaking bad. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We conclude the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon's first term ended with the hope for a complete American withdrawal from the war in Vietnam. Yet, Americans were still angry about the war and its economic effects on life at home. Inflation and unemployment were both high. Some political observers thought Nixon would not win a second term. Nixon, however, was sure the American people would support him. He did not actively campaign in the state primary elections leading up to the Republican nominating convention. He focused much of his attention on foreign policy, including his historic trip to China in February 1972. In May, he traveled to Austria, the Soviet Union, Iran, and Poland. In Moscow, he signed the first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, with the Soviets. But back in Washington, something happened. It was a small incident, but one that would have a huge effect. On June 17, 1972, five men wearing surgical gloves broke into the headquarters of the Democratic Party. The Democratic National Committee offices were located in one of the buildings in a complex called Watergate. Police caught the burglars, and at the time, the incident did not seem very important. But the men carried papers that linked them to top officials in the Nixon White House. The question was, did the president know what was going on? Nixon denied any wrongdoing. In time, the Watergate break-in would lead to a congressional investigation. But in the summer of 1972, attention focused on the presidential nominating conventions. Democrats met in Miami Beach, Florida, and chose George McGovern, a senator from South Dakota, as their candidate for president. The Republicans also met in Miami Beach and, as expected, nominated Richard Nixon for a second term. McGovern, a liberal, attacked Nixon for his policies on Vietnam. However, Nixon easily won the 1972 election. He defeated McGovern, carrying 49 of the 50 states. But the shadow of Watergate would not go away. Two young reporters for the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, had been following the story since the break-in. In early 1973, they found evidence that linked the break-in to White House officials. The evidence also showed that these officials tried to use government agencies to hide the connection. The burglars had been financed with money connected to the committee to re-elect the president. Pressure grew for a full investigation. In April, President Nixon ordered the Justice Department to carry it out. Attorney General Elliot Richardson appointed law professor Archibald Cox as a special prosecutor to lead the investigation.
The committee will come to Alma.
In May, a special Senate committee began its own investigation. A former White House lawyer, John Dean, provided the major evidence.
It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the president is forgiven.
By July, the public learned that President Nixon had made tape recordings of some of his discussions and telephone calls. The Senate committee asked him for some of the tapes. Nixon refused. He said, "The President of the United States has a constitutional right to keep such records private." A federal judge, John Sirica, ordered the president to surrender the tapes. Lawyers for the president took the case to the Supreme Court. The High Court supported Sirica's decision. After that, pressure increased for Nixon to cooperate. In October, he offered to provide written transcripts of parts of the recordings. Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, rejected the offer. So Nixon ordered Attorney General Richardson to dismiss him. Richardson, the nation's top law enforcement officer, refused. Instead, he resigned, as did his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, when Nixon ordered him to fire Cox.
The Watergate drama has taken a half year to unfold. The president's unique actions in firing two popular and respected members of the executive branch and forcing a third to quit took less than 8 hours. The impact of all this, clearly colossal and yet to be measured.
Jerry Landay reporting for ABC News. The incident happened on a Saturday night and became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Nixon then had Acting Attorney General Robert Bork dismiss Cox, and the president eliminated the office of special prosecutor. He gave the Justice Department the responsibility of continuing the investigation. President Nixon had another political problem in addition to Watergate. In late 1973, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign. A court had found Agnew guilty of violating tax laws. President Nixon asked Gerald Ford to become the new vice president. Ford was a longtime member of Congress from Michigan. By that time, some members of Congress were talking about trying to remove Nixon from office. Was the president covering up important evidence in the Watergate case? Was he, in fact, guilty of crimes? In April 1974, Nixon surrendered some of the recordings of conversations in his office. However, three important ones were missing. The Nixon administration tried to explain, saying the tape machine had failed to record two of those conversations. The third recording, it said, had been erased accidentally. This became known as the famous 18-minute gap. Many Americans did not believe these explanations. 2 months later, the Supreme Court ruled that a president cannot hold back evidence in a criminal case. It said there is no presidential right of privacy in such a case. Congress moved ahead with efforts to bring charges against the president.
Congress now has no alternative but to institute impeachment proceedings.
In July 1974, a committee in the House of Representatives proposed to impeach Nixon, that is, put the president on trial in the Senate. If Nixon were found guilty of crimes connected to the Watergate case, he would be removed from office. Finally, Nixon surrendered the last of the documents sought by congressional investigators. These documents appeared to provide proof that the president had ordered a cover-up of evidence in the Watergate burglary. Every president promises to protect and defend the Constitution. The congressional investigation showed that Nixon had repeatedly misused government agencies in an effort to hide wrongdoing and punish his critics. The hearings also showed that he had tried to block the investigation. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon spoke to the nation. His long struggle to remain in office was over.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
By resigning, Nixon avoided impeachment and possible imprisonment. Never before had an American president resigned. On August 9th, Nixon's vice president, Gerald Ford, was sworn in as the nation's 38th president. Soon after becoming president, Gerald Ford made a surprise announcement.
I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. But it is not the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon that most concerns me, though surely it deeply troubles every decent and every compassionate person. My concern is the immediate future of this great country.
He pardoned Richard Nixon. Many Americans criticized Ford for doing this, but the new president believed he had good reason. Ford wanted to deal with the other problems facing the nation. He did not want Watergate to go on and on, but the investigation did go on. A number of officials in the Nixon administration went to prison. The effects of Watergate on public opinion and public policy would be felt for years to come. For example, Congress passed laws designed to prevent an administration from using its power to punish opponents. Nixon's abuses also led Congress to order government agencies to provide more information about their intelligence gathering activities. Nixon's actions violated the basic trust between the American public and their elected officials. It led to more aggressive reporting by a new generation of journalists hoping to follow in the footsteps of Woodward and Bernstein. Their coverage of Watergate won a Pulitzer Prize, one of journalism's top awards, and led to a movie based on their book, All the President's Men. It starred Robert Redford as Bob Woodward and Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. Jason Robards played Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley.
You got more than one source.
Yes, Harry.
Who are they?
Sloan.
Sloan and who else?
And there's another guy, Justice, who so far won't confirm the names of the other two who control the fund that we're working on.
What deep throat. He's not a source on this.
But do any of them have an axe?
No. Nope.
Personal, political, sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No. Nope.
Can we use the names?
No.
When is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook. Just be sure you're right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.